Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, and today we're talking about your pet's health with Dr. Bill Stork. Back with us on the show, he's the owner of the Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic, also the author of several books. We'll hear what Dr. Stork has to say about keeping your pet's ears healthy and why dogs' tails wag, plus an update on the respiratory virus going around. So as we talk with him, I hope you'll join in. Questions you have about your dog or cat's health? Love to hear from you. Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234, or email to ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Bill Stork, welcome back. Great to have you with us.
Well, good morning, Larry. Glad to be here, although I feel we've got a little bit of pressure today because we're following up a show on intimacy in film, and we're supposed to be talking about dogs' ears and wagging their tails. So we're going to have to pick up the pace today, man.
I tell you what, let's get to tail wagging. Why do dogs wag their tails?
Well, there's a question that has been contemplated from academics and anthropomorphics forever and a day. And when Clara proposed this topic, I took a shallow dive into some of the research. And it's some have speculated that over the millennia, we have selected for dogs because we as people, and I found to be a little bit entertaining, we as people have a tendency to like rhythm, and dogs that wag their tail provide rhythm. So is there a possibility that we actually selected our pets for dogs that wag their tail more? Personally, I think there's a pretty decent chance that one of the reasons why dogs wag their tail from an evolutionary standpoint is because we reward them for it. We give them attention. We give them treats. And therefore they wag their tails, so they get rewarded for it. But you're 110% correct in the sense that we have a lot of people who will come in the room and will say things like, well, he wagged his tail, so he must like me. He wagged his tail, so he must be happy. And you even alluded to this in your introduction that it means they're happy. Could be. It means they're excited. That's one of the things that we do know with a fair bit of confidence, that when dogs wag their tail, it's because they're excited. But there's more to it than that, because when you start looking more closely, the question becomes, how do they wag their tail? How do they carry their tail when they wag it? And I consulted our behaviorist here at the clinic, Mitzi Voiles, and she tells us stuff like, if they wag their tail high, it can be a warning flag. That can be a sign of confidence in the interaction that the dog is about to experience. If they wag their tail low, it could be just the opposite. And that is a dog that is not so confident, and possibly a dog that is a little bit fearful. There was a group in Italy that went so far as to do research on which direction the dogs wag their tail. And the Italians learned that, and by the way, the materials and methods in some of this research was a little bit fascinating, because they had to remove all outside bias. So, of course, they called in a robotic dog for the test dogs to approach. And from that, we are to make some judgments as to what those dogs are thinking. But the Italians felt that if the dogs wagged their tail to the right, then they were approaching somebody that they approved of and they were looking forward to seeing. Now, interestingly, maybe breed comes to play into this situation.
Yeah.
Maybe if you run into a Newfoundland or a Labrador Retriever or a Chesapeake Bay Retriever, it could be just the opposite, because the Canadians felt that if the dogs wagged their tail to the left, that means they were approaching a relationship that they approved of. So, as I said at the beginning, we've speculated about this from an academic standpoint, and it's really difficult not to drop into anthropomorphism at some point in time. But at the end of the day, we never look at just the tail wag, because it's human nature. Whether you're a professional or whether you just like to spend time around dogs, you look at the rest of that body, that dog's body language. You know, what is the position of their ears, their pupils, their eyes? Do they approach you? Do they cower under the bench? At the end of the day, we look at all of the dog's behaviors to be able to make those judgments.
It's interesting that there's been research on wolves and fox, and the wild canids tend not to wag their tail very much.
For the reasons just mentioned, yeah.
Yeah. So it's kind of interesting. Well, can our understanding of tail wagging help us to be better pet owners?
Well, without a doubt, our understanding of body language and positioning can help us be pet owners with absolute certainty. Here at the Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic, we do a lecture each year on just exactly that. And there's a lot of information out there about nonverbal, which I suppose all of pets' communication is nonverbal, but their body language goes a long way.
Dr. Bill Stork, our guest, owner of the Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic. Questions for him, give a call. The number's 800-642-1234, or you can email us to ideas@wpr.org. Bill, you have some updates about the respiratory disease that appeared in many dogs a few months back. What do we know about it now?
Probably fairly similar to what I understand you had some clinicians from the University of Wisconsin Veterinary School on a week or so ago. And the consensus statement among the veterinary community is that it's really difficult for us to say that there is an uptick in respiratory disease more than we see at this time of year when dogs are in close spaces, when dogs have a tendency to be kenneled or boarded as their owners are going on vacation and visiting family over the holidays. And one of the phrases that we hear a lot on our side of the exam table is that new respiratory virus or that novel respiratory virus. And as close as we can tell, it's not new or it's not novel. It falls within the group of organisms that we fairly frequently see. And, you know, is there an echo in the room? The discussion is fairly similar to what we do for people in the sense that, you know, if your pet is healthy, if your pet has an intact immune system, if it's middle-aged and strong, then don't curtail that dog's lifestyle in fear of the respiratory disease, because the lack of socialization, the lack of exercise is going to make a much bigger impact than that respiratory disease, which the enormous majority of the patients that we see recover just fine.
Jason in Algoma has a question for you, Dr. Stork. Let's go to Jason. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hello, Dr. Stork. Hello, Larry.
Hi.
About Christmas time, my dog, I had her running out in the woods, and she had gotten a scratch on her right eye. And so the eye had become infected, so we brought her to the vet. And the vet did some UV drops and shined a light and said, yes, she has a scratch. So he put her in a cone, and he gave her some bacitracin ointment. So we've been doing that for a week. We brought her back to the vet, and the eye still was not healed. So he prescribed another ointment. We put that on for a week. Now she goes back tomorrow, which is Wednesday. And he said, if it's not healed, what he's going to try to do is he's going to try to rough up the edges where the scratch was.
You bet. It's one of the most unnerving things that we deal with. Yeah, he's what he's talking about is a grid keratectomy, but What happened to your dog when it was out running around in the woods is a scratch that is deep enough that we classify that as a corneal ulcer. And some about half of those dogs that we see clear up easily in a week or so. Others become an incredible challenge to get them to heal up. So, yeah, what your veterinarian is doing is exactly what most of us do, which when he roughs it up, what he's doing is he's stimulating the healing process on the surface of the eye.
There you go. Thank you so much, Jason, for calling. Good luck with your dog. Let's go to Robert in Oconomowoc. Hi, Robert.
Good morning. My question has to do with the genetics of the dog that we adopted. It's a rescue dog, and when we did the DNA test on it, it turned out that the dog was 100% American Foxhound, which we were a little surprised at. They also give you the rescue organization gives you information on the relatives of the dog. And so I went through 44 additional dogs that were related to our dog, Joey, and it turned out 38 out of 35 total were all 100% American Foxhound. And that just seems highly unlikely considering all the various sources that rescue dogs can come from. And I'm wondering what sort of function could be, causing this outcome. Is it something within the genetic testing process, or could it be that American Foxhounds have something genetically that limits their reproductive nature, except when they're with other foxhounds? I just don't understand.
Interesting.
Man, that would be a good case to put in front of the vet school or to put in front of people who specialize in reproductive medicine. And, I'm with you in speculating on that situation because the likelihood just seems like one heck of a stretch in my mind. And in my experience with regard to the DNA tests, there's only as good as the number of repetitions that they do. And to be honest with you, I don't know enough about the intricacies of that test to question the test itself. But I couldn't agree with you more, Robert, that it really does seem like a stretch that that many dogs could be straight up American Foxhound, because I've just not known dogs to be that discriminatory when it comes to time to breed.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. Robert, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in too. Number to call 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org. What's going on with your pet's health? Love to hear from you. And really glad to have Clara Neipert as our producer today and also Trina LaSousa as our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Great to have you with us today as we talk your pet's health with Dr. Bill Stork, owner of the Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic. Great to have him back, and I hope you'll join in with your questions. What's going on with the health of your cat or dog? Love to hear from you. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address ideas@wpr.org. Let's talk ears for a little bit, Dr. Bill. How can you tell if your pet has an ear infection?
Well, the things that they will do when your dog has an ear infection, they'll oftentimes shake their head. They'll oftentimes scratch their ears with their back legs. They'll rub them on the couch. They'll rub them on the furniture. Then we start to consider, is this just about the ears or is this about the skin and the ears? Because certainly there are times when the ears all by themselves are infected. But one of the things that we have to keep in mind is that the ears are also part of the skin. And there are times when dogs are overall allergic, and that will manifest also as irritation in their ears as well. So the next thing you do when you become suspicious that your dog could have an ear infection when they're shaking their head, when they're rubbing their ears, is pick them up and look inside. And maybe you'll just find that there's some debris, some dark granular debris, some waxy debris. But then you have to make a judgment beyond that, because the skin should look healthy and pink and dry after you have cleaned those ears out. And if it is red and angry and weepy, if the debris that you pull out of there is dark and granular and bloody or yellow and purulent, then that could be an indication of an ear infection. Just because they shake their head and rub their ears does not mean it has to be infected. And so frequently people will ask questions like, well, where do dogs get ear infections from? And in the summertime, when dogs are jumping in the lake and swimming, that's a pretty easy answer. But as you might expect, there's a lot fewer dogs that are going for a swim this time of year. And we still see ear infections. And the best answer that I've been able to come up with is the ears. Because I simply can't imagine a better place to grow things than inside of an ear. It's warm, it's moist, it's 102 degrees. There's sloughing cells, there's blood, there's wax, there's exudate. And it's a really great place to grow things. And frankly, I don't know why all ears aren't infected. And sometimes people get a little bit hesitant with regard to cleaning their dog's ears out because they've read, or intuitively they're afraid of doing damage to the eardrum. You're not going to do damage to your dog's eardrum if you use a swab, if you use a cotton ball, if you use your finger and a 4x4, if you always stay vertical with regard to the dog's head. The ear canal is in the shape of an L, and you don't even come close to the eardrum until you turn the corner and go towards the dog's head. But what we really want not to do, some of the things that we want not to do, is we want to make sure that we don't shove things deeper in that ear. If you get out the cotton swabs, you can do that with great caution, making sure you're always pulling things out of the ears and not pushing things down into the ears. And then be really careful with what you put in the ears. Back in the, you know, I've heard of people using dilute peroxide. Please don't. That would be very, very irritating. And we don't want to use anything that's oily, because things that are oily will create a film and kind of seal that ear up.
So be a little careful when you're doing it, for sure. Amy in Waupun has a question for us. Let's go there.
Yes, I'm sorry if you already addressed this issue. I just tuned in. I have a 3-year-old male cat that's neutered, and a couple years ago he had problems with urinary crystals, and my vet put him on antibiotics and whatnot and cleared it up. He put him on Hill's brand CD, and he's doing very well on it, but it's so very expensive. I just wondered if you had something else that you might recommend. Just wanted another opinion.
Yeah, Amy, that's a really good question, and that's a conversation that I had with a client in the exam room 10 minutes ago. And while we completely and totally agree with regard to the expense of the Hills CD, it's really good at preventing crystals. There are two other prescription manufacturers of dissolution diets, and the magic in that CD, what makes it so expensive, is that it prevents the formation of crystals. And there are foods out there on the grocery store shelf that say for urinary health, but they don't have the matrix that prevents the the formation of crystals. And while we completely and totally agree with regard to the expense, one, an obstructed cat, a cat with a urinary obstruction, is a medical emergency, and it's really, really painful. And I don't know what it's like around Waupun, but there's not always an emergency clinic available here in South Central Wisconsin. In addition to the fact that a trip to us when we have to anesthetize, place a urinary catheter and an intravenous catheter and hospitalize these cats, it gets really expensive in a hurry. And as I said, it's a medical emergency and it's really painful for the cat. So I would powerfully recommend sticking with those prescription diets. Personally, I have a cat that is absolutely dependent upon the dissolution diets. And once upon a time, I thought I was just going to mix a little bit of over-the-counter food in with his dissolution diet, and the guy was straining within a week.
I had exactly the same experience with my cat. I quickly changed my mind went with the full time on the CD because I had Amy had the same thing with Coco, one of my two cats. So unfortunately, I think you have to stay with it despite the cost. And I think that's what you're saying, Bill.
Absolutely. It's just, I wouldn't recommend taking the chance. I learned from my cat, the Big Stink.
Yeah. Amy, good luck. Thank you for calling. Greg in Green Bay, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Greg.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question is about my dog, a rescue dog. She's a Samoyed Husky Chow mix. We did her DNA, you know that. So it needs to stay a big fur coat, for a hair coat. And she always wants to be out. Really have trouble getting her in. The coldest nights, we just worry about her being out. And we've brought her in for a few hours to warm up. And then she wants to go back out. Are we doing more harm than good bringing her in for a few hours to warm up?
You know, it's always been one of the wonders of the world to me that dogs can go from laying in front of the fire, laying on the couch, to taking a nap on top of a snowbank. But I will tell you, Greg, that's what those dogs were bred to do. And I don't feel like you're doing any harm by bringing your dog inside. But at the same time, you know, some of the things you want to absolutely ensure is that you have a thawed ubiquitous water supply out there so that they have access to water, because that's really important for thermoregulation and protection from the wind. And I believe your dog is very clearly making his preference known that he can handle it.
Yeah, there you go. Maybe a doghouse outside where he can go in and come out as he sees fit.
You bet.
Yeah. Vivian in Green Bay mentions, talking about the dog, about the foxhound rescue, maybe these dogs, Vivian says, maybe these dogs came from a foxhound puppy mill rescue.
That's a great idea. Maybe it wasn't quite the random sample that we think of when we think about rescues.
Yeah.
That's a great idea.
Yeah. Ann in Nisida, it's your turn. Hi, Ann.
Good morning. Thank you so very much for this program. I have recently adopted a 5-year-old black Labrador retriever that has not been neutered. And I have always neutered all my pets, neutered and spayed all my cats and dogs. But I've heard a lot of controversy recently about not neutering dogs because of health concerns. And I'm not so much a fan of that, but I want to know, are there pros and cons to neutering versus not neutering my dog? Like I said, I recently adopted him. He's 5 years old, and he's never been neutered. So
okay.
I'm leaning towards neutering.
Okay.
Well, and there's, first of all, there's a whole show all by itself on the debate with regard to the timing of and if and when to neuter. But first of all, another question, his personality, I take it that if you chose to adopt him and bring him home, he's got a pretty easygoing personality.
He's just a big baby. He's awesome. And he doesn't, well, he has a pup, a 6 or 7 month old puppy that came out of his running. But since I've adopted him, he has not run away. We play constantly. He's a tennis ball fanatic. In fact, I say he has OTB, which is obsessive tennis ball.
Yeah.
And so he's not a runner. He has not been run. He has not run away since I've adopted him. And that was last October. But I'm more concerned with his health. Is he better off not to be neutered but as far as personality, absolutely no issues there whatsoever.
Perfect. And that was my assumption. So with regard to his health, you may be thinking about things like testicular issues and testicular cancer. And we honestly don't see a great deal of testicular cancer in dogs. And part of the reason for that, maybe we don't see a whole lot of intact male dogs. We see more intact male dogs than we used to. That is absolutely certain. One of the two of the health risks that we can see associated with leaving him intact are testicular torsion, which is intuitively excruciatingly painful, and two, a medical emergency, but also very, very infrequently seen. The other potential health-related issue with an intact male is also prostate issues, because intact male dogs are more prone to a condition called prostatic hyperplasia. Prostate cancer also exists in intact male dogs, not that frequently. The benefits to potentially keeping him intact at this point in time are intact male dogs have a tendency to be more muscular. As far as down the road, you know, as a 5-year-old dog becomes a 9, 10, 11, 12-year-old dog, they have a tendency to carry a little bit more muscle into older age. So it's not nearly as black and white as it used to be. There's a whole heck of a lot of debate as far as the timing, and I'll answer the other questions that could be out there with regard to timing of the neutering. We used to, in a knee-jerk fashion, think in terms of neutering dogs in the vicinity of 6 to 8 months of age before they reached sexual maturity. That can still be a recommendation, but there are also some recommendations to delaying that neuter to 12 to 14 months of age. And I know this isn't speaking specifically to your dog. The thinking is that they're slightly less likely to develop hip and knee issues and slightly less likely to develop a couple of different types of cancers. Those numbers are difficult to sort out, and the differences are small, and just don't be swayed. If you see an article that says neutering my dog at 6 months of age causes anterior cruciate ligament disease and hip dysplasia, that's not the case. Just slightly more represented. So hopefully that helps a little bit. There's very little downside to having him neutered at this point.
Okay. There you go, Ann. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Sue in Mequon, your turn. Hi, Sue.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I was wondering your thoughts on adding water to dogs' kibble. I feel like they're really inefficient drinkers. Mine are. They've got more water on the floor than any place else. And so I started adding water to their kibble. And I just was reading something recently that I thought, oh, maybe that's not the best idea. Can you give me some assistance here?
Well, maybe a little bit more information, Sue. What breed and how old are your dogs?
Well, I have one that's 12, and he's a mixed breed. Then he's kind of like a very delicate little Labrador look, is his look. And the other one's a Border Collie, and he's 14. And the one that's the most kind of issue is the mixed breed, because he chomps his food down, and occasionally he's like chokes on it, and then he spits it out, and you get some blood coming out too. So when I came upon the strategy of watering down his kibble, we haven't had that problem anymore.
Okay. Yeah, and I was suspicious that your dogs could be a little bit older. And under those circumstances, I think watering down their food is a really good idea, because by my way of thinking, it just seems as if the food is going to go down more as a bolus than as kibble. And as these dogs age, the choking that you describe could be associated with this condition called megaesophagus, and they just don't transport their food quite as well as they used to. So, and there's also a decent chance that in a 12 and a 14 year old dogs that their dental health is not perfect. And at this stage of the game, that wetted up food very well may be easier for them to assimilate.
Makes sense. Sue, thank you for calling. You can join in too. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email to ideas at WPR.org. Give a call. We'll get you on pretty quickly. Diane in Madison emailed us. One of her cats had crystals in her urine, and the vet prescribed CD. Diane hates the ingredients in CD that are mostly corn. How much of a concern is that? Diane prefers cat foods with meat as primary ingredient.
Well, we're with you, Diane, in that sense, absolutely, positively. But what I'm going to circle back to is that the crystals can become a life-threatening emergency, and they can reoccur with absolute certainty. Now, there's a website out there called Balance It. And Balance It is a website that is designed for people who want to cook for their pets and put together their own diets. Now, there very well may be a diet out there that you can build your own dissolution diet. And for clarity, let me also say, other things that can contribute to, the other things that can prevent crystal formation is dilution. You know, the solution is dilution. And the more water you get into those animals, the less likely they are to form those crystals. So these foods are not the only answer in the whole wide world. They're just the most reliable. And so if you can get lots of water in your cats, more than they might otherwise consume, then there's less of a chance that they're going to form those crystals. So we're always playing benefits versus risk in any decision we make, and that's one of them.
Rachel in Oshkosh emailed, can you please touch on spaying female dogs? She has a 6-year-old Siberian Husky not spayed. Curious if she should.
Rachel, I would. And the reason why I would is because of a condition called pyometra, and pio pus mitra uterus. And a condition that is fairly common in older intact female dogs is somewhere in the vicinity of 6 weeks to 3 months after they've been in heat, they develop an infection in their uterus, and that becomes life-threatening. That's an emergency surgery. Back in veterinary school, they used to tell us never let the sun set on a pyometra. And it's, as I said at the top, that's a condition that happens fairly frequently, and it's a life-threatening issue. And oftentimes, when these dogs develop a pyometra, they're not as good a surgical patient as your six-year-old dog is today.
Hmm. Okay, there we go. Ken in Madison, we'll give you a shot here. Hi, Ken.
Hi. Excellent show, excellent guest. Thank you. My cat is 10 years old. She's a American short hair, and she's had oily ears her entire life. From the time I adopted her as a kitten, you know, to today. And when she goes in for the different reasons to the vet, they always want to clean her ear. And I say, yeah, go ahead. But, you know, of course, I'm paying for it. But it comes right back. And, you know, she scratches her ear. She shakes her head. And loves me, you know, rubbing her ear or just my index finger in her ear to get some of the oil out. But she's had this her entire life. Any ideas?
Oh, yeah, Ken. First of all, we have about a dozen of your cats in our practice that are just exactly that way. They never go outside. And every single solitary time we see them, their ears are full of oily black discharge. And I'll circle back to what I said at the top, which is, you know, it's the nature of ears. There's discharge, there's exudate, there's blood, there's wax, it's warm, it's moist, it's a dead end. And some cats don't, and many cats do. And you just kind of have to make a decision whether you're going to let us clean them out when we see them or whether you're going to clean them out yourself. Because we've seen if they don't get cleaned out, they can get pretty gnarly down in there and pretty red and angry and infected.
Ken, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Dr. Bill Stork, owner of Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic, our guest today. I'm Larry Mehler for the Ideas Network. Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mehler here. We talk your pet's health today with Dr. Bill Stork, owner of the Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic. Great to have him back. And thank you for listening in today on the Ideas Network. Juliana in Muskego has a question for you, Dr. Bill. Let's go there. Hi, Juliana.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have about a year and a half old male dog. He's small. He was like a cavalier mix of some kind. We rescued him. And we got him when he was about 5 months old. And shortly after that, he would mark and he would pee on various things in the house. And so and one aspect is that we have two senior dogs who occasionally have accidents. But I mean, we used all the products that get rid of the smell, did all that. Finally, we had him neutered a little bit earlier than we wanted to, at about 7 months. And that seemed to take care of the problem. But lately, now he's a year and a half old, he has started marking. And he'll do things like mark on the other dog's bed, you know, and things like that. And I just, you know, I've tried, you know, cleaners that take the smell away and you know, we wash the floor wherever he did it, but suggestions, I'd be really open to any.
Hello, Juliana, and good luck with an ever so challenging issue. A question that I will ask is, do you ever catch him or see him doing it? And if so, how do you react?
So my husband has caught him, and he would say no. He would interrupt him. Not like cruel or anything, but just stop. And he would, you know, he would. It happened a few times. Mm-hmm.
You bet. And that's an excellent reaction on his part. So first of all, I will back up and make kind of a broad statement. And that is that When people come to us and ask us about the timing of neutering their dogs, in larger breeds of dogs, we will oftentimes talk about the delayed neuter. In smaller breeds of dogs, for the challenge that Juliana is experiencing at this very moment, we will recommend having them neutered earlier, because if anyone is to mark just a clinical impression here, there's nothing scientific about it, but it has a tendency to be those little guys. So this is a straight up behavior problem. And he is clearly overmarking the other dogs. And these are really challenging issues to try and overcome. And one of the tools that we will use is we rewind to puppyhood. And granted, he's only about a year and a half old, so it's not that far of a rewind. But what you end up doing is have to reinforce all of the things that you did to puppy train that, house train that dog in the first place, which is he's either in his crate where he's not going to urinate, or he is directly observed when he is at large in the house. He doesn't get an opportunity to seek out those spaces that he has been urinating on, or he is supervised outside, which I don't know what it's like in Muskego today, but it's a sloppy, stinking mess in South Central Wisconsin. It wouldn't be that fun standing outside with your dog so that you can reward him for going to the bathroom outside. I'm glad to hear that you're not punishing him for the marking, because that will just make him hide from you when he does it. So rewinding to initial house training is a tool that can serve you well, keeping him in the crate except when you can observe him. And the minute that kid starts to lift his leg on a spot or squat on a spot, then he gets scooted outside and rewarded for going to the bathroom outside. And I just described a really labor-intense process, but that's what it's going to take. Or you'll have to wear a diaper.
Yeah. There you go, Juliana. Dave in Wisconsin Rapids, turning to you now. Thanks for calling, Dave.
Hey, yeah, great show, great guest. My question is about kibble, and I've thought about this for a long time. I've got a daughter who claims that her young terrier-type dog is a child of hers. She loves kibble, had issues with it, was throwing up, couldn't really get the kibble down, so they started watering it like we heard a previous caller. But my question is kibble in general. You know, for tens of thousands of years, dogs ate what we ate. And then, of course, in our modern society, we eat so terribly that it's not suitable for a dog. But why is kibble? Is there a benefit to kibble, or should we just cook them some chicken and, you know, stuff and feed them that way?
Man, boy, there's a ton of debate in there, Dave. So what is the benefit to kibble? The benefit to kibble is convenience. You know, why are 60% of the meals consumed in American households contains something that is pre-prepared and pre-made? And it really is about convenience. And lots of people have really passionate ideas about the ingredients in there. I mean, we heard about a lady that doesn't like the idea that there's corn in cat food, and that's absolutely legitimate. When you open your cat's mouth and you look in that mouth, those teeth are not designed for eating corn. Those teeth are designed for eating chickens and whatever it is that they can catch. So absolutely, if you don't mind the expense, if you don't mind the time, then cooking for your dog is a wonderful way to go. And, you know, as you said, for tens of thousands of years, dogs and cats would eat whatever was slower than they were that they could catch. And what the updated version of that is, as I referred to earlier about this website called Balance It. And what Balance It does is if you have chicken, if you have pork, if you have beef, if you have venison, you can plug that in. And then there are some other ingredients that come into play, some vegetables and minerals and things like that. But convenience is the advantage of kibble. And we have clients that spend every other Saturday cooking for their dogs and essentially make the equivalent of sausage for their dogs. And their dogs do great and they live wonderful long lives.
Hmm. And there you go, Dave. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Melissa in Eau Claire will give you a chance. Hi, Melissa.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. Kind of dog food question and issue here. I've got a five-month-old King Corso Mastiff that he's on a large breed puppy food. It's the same one that they had him on when we purchased him. And we've been thinking about going to grain-free dog food. And I'm wondering if that would be a better option or do they need to have that grain in there? And the second part would be he's obsessed with eating paper towels. And we're wondering if that is something that is like a breed thing or like it's very bad. Like he is really all about eating paper towels. And so we were kind of wondering about that too.
Well, the good news is paper towels should not be obstructive in a five-year-old cane Corso. And first of all, Melissa, before we get to the answering the food questions, you could be very helpful to us in helping us decipher this tail wagging situation because the Canadians and their breeds say that their dogs are happy when they wag their tail to the left, and your cane Corso is an Italian breed. So if you can get an idea as to which direction your dog wags its tail when it approaches somebody that it really, really likes, that could help our research out tremendously. But with regard to the grain-free food, and I'm going to go a little bit rogue here. A while ago, there was some research out there that threw darts at grain-free food and associated it with some cardiac conditions that existed in a population of dogs. And for a while, we were traveling along thinking that grain-free was not a good idea because of its association with this cardiac condition. Well, then science dug a little bit deeper into those numbers and debunked that and found out that grain-free is not so associated with these cardiac conditions. I don't have a problem with grain in dog food. I don't want grain to be the first ingredients. We definitely want meat to be the first ingredient in the food. I really feel that it's valuable for a dog's gut to see a diversity of ingredients.
Well, there you go. Mike from Algoma emailed us. They spent $700 for an emergency vet visit because dental chews that were advertised as 100% soluble were not. Their dog had a blockage because the dental chew pieces did not pass. He's okay after throwing the pieces back up. As a test, Mike put a fresh chunk of the chew in water, and then he added vinegar, and after 3 days, it was as hard as it when he first dropped it in.
To be cautious, and I will broaden that discussion a lot. There's a lot of discussion out there with regard to things like raw hides and bully sticks and stuff like that. I would be really, really cautious if your dog is an aggressive chewer with unattended raw hides and things like that that take a good long time to digest in the stomach.
But these, I tell you, if it's taken after 3 days, it was still hard.
Well, that's a thing, but I'm thinking the pH of the stomach is in the vicinity of 1.8. And I bet that the pH in his glass of water and vinegar was probably not quite that acidic. So it, I mean, it's meaningful, but it's not the whole answer. But yeah, I mean, clearly his dog was having a tough time with that thing being down in there, and that's not good.
Dr. Bill Stork, our guest, he is the owner of Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic. He's authored 3 books, contributes newspaper articles to local papers, does a great job of communicating, and it's great to have him with us today. And he'll be with us right up until 12:30. So for those of you who are waiting online, hang in there. He will be back with me right after this look at the news. And we'll find out, too, what else is in store for us. Number to call is 800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. We're talking about pet care on the show today with Dr. Bill Stork, owner of the and operator of the Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic. Works with both small and large animals. And I hope you'll join in. Tell us how your pets are doing. What questions do you have about your animal's care? Love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. And let's take a call. Liz in Madison, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Hi, thanks for taking my call, and what a great show.
Thank you.
So I'm calling about my 7.5-year-old Jack Russell Terrier, purebred. I've owned, she would be my 4th Jack Russell. And first one with so many sort of allergy issues. When she was about 2 years old, we noticed that she would have a season where she got very, very itchy, and to the point of, you know, she would scratch herself raw and bleed, et cetera. So we had our vet at the time do a comprehensive panel that told us all the food she was allergic to, all the trees, all the grasses. She's even allergic to human dander. So just a real problem. We did kind of the conventional route of Apoquil, and that didn't work. So now we've been doing steroids about 6 weeks a year, which is in pill form. And up until this past season, and grant you, our seasons are kind of changing here in Wisconsin. They're getting, you know, I don't know if we're a couple weeks off or what, but we gave her steroids, and, you know, they helped a little bit, but they didn't quite do it. And she's actually been uncomfortable since. So And what we're feeding her is Dignature. We found that had none of the things on her food panel that she was allergic to, and we feed her kangaroo version of that. And we've sort of switched around. And incidentally, we also give her – so for a while I did that whole thing of making their food, et cetera, and it just – I must have done it for about 6 months, and it did become a chore. So yeah. now we're wondering, and we honestly, we don't know if her continuous itching past, when the weather gets cool, if it's food related or if it's, you know, something in the house related, all of the things that we do are for sensitive skin. No sense, no anything like that. So we've considered doing the science diet, and just wondering what you think about that.
Sure. All right.
All right, Liz, big topic, and we spend a lot of time with skin cases. And I can imagine that if you were cooking for your dog, it probably wasn't all that easy for you to source kangaroo there in Madison without going to the novel protein diet that you were buying. So what I tell people at the beginning, in the middle, and the end of skin appointments is that skin is the type of thing that has a tendency to be more managed than it does fixed. And you just described some of the challenges that you've had with regard to getting your dog under control. And for me to comment specifically on all the intricacies of that would be next to impossible without this, without the history. I can tell you that over the years, we have had dogs, and what you're describing with regard to the prescription diet is called hydrolyzed protein. It is the holy grail of hypoallergenic diets. And we have had dogs that have responded beautifully to that. But one of the things you have to keep in mind is that that's all that dog eats. And that's what the treats are. That's what the food is. And they don't get a grain of popcorn. They don't get a Charlie Bear. They don't get a Zook. They don't get freeze-dried liver. They get hydrolyzed protein, and that's it. And the other thing, it requires a measure of patience in the sense that if there is a food component that is contributing to these allergies, it takes at least 8 to 12 weeks in the absence of that allergy for us to be able to conclude that that food is helping or it is not. The other thing is a lesson that we've learned here. Obviously, this has been taking place for a long time. You've been several seasons, several years. One of the questions that I will sometimes circle back and ask my patient is to just absolutely make sure that that the dog has been scraped for mites and there's no chance of them having microscopic mites. And they can, I bet your veterinarian has checked for that along the way. But when I hear that a dog just doesn't respond to an appropriate dose of Apoquel, Cytopoint, or steroids, then sometimes I'll circle back and say, man, is there any chance that that dog could have mites? And I won't go into where he could have gotten them, but it's a slim possibility.
All right. Liz, thank you. Good luck. Appreciate your call. Jenny in La Crosse, your turn. Hi, Jenny.
Hello. How are you doing today?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, my daughter is taking care of a cat that we rescued from the local neighborhood. The owner had passed away from cancer, and his kids just, their solution was to turn the cat out and occasionally feed it a can of tuna. When we got it, it was barely 5 pounds, infested with fleas, extremely anemic, but ironically, all the chemistry stuff looked fine. They estimated the cat somewhere around 10 to 12 years old. I would guess from the dental, he's missing a few teeth and stuff, but that's probably pretty close to where it is. Now, since she has him, we brought him up to around 7 pounds, and he's flea-free and doing much better, but he's still having problems in his gut with diarrhea every time he goes to the bathroom. And it doesn't seem like anything we do can really remedy that. I'm wondering, I was told that probiotics might help if there's some sort of parasitic infection. Like I said, this chemistry of kidneys and everything are fine. And I was just wondering if you had any other recommendations.
I do. And first of all, I will say that these things can be elusive and challenging. And some of the things that we will try when we are faced with cats that have chronically loose stools. Well, I assume there has been an internal parasite test done looking for the eggs of worms. That's the first level of intervention. Sometimes, especially if a cat has spent some time outside, we'll just deworm them. We'll just go scorched earth and do a really broad spectrum dose of dewormer for a meaningful period of time to see if things will get better there. Then there is a somewhat new. We've had it for a few years. There's a really specific, really sensitive fecal test called a fecal PCR. And what that does is it looks for the DNA of some of the more common intestinal organisms that we will find. And we have found some answers and some cures by way of doing that test called the fecal PCR. So those are some of the things that we have found to be helpful in cats like that. And by the way, thanks for taking care of the cat that was otherwise has had some bad luck.
Yeah, absolutely. Jenny, thank you for calling. Tony in Mount Horeb, your turn. Hi, Tony.
Good morning or good afternoon. I was wondering about the efficacy of every 6 months dental sealants for a cat. We have a 6-year-old. A couple years ago when we got her, she had a dental, and we've been paying every 6 months to have a Sanos sealant done, of course, with the exam, the labs, and sedation. It ends up being pretty spendy anyway. But are you better off just waiting until they actually need a dental, or is the every 6 months sealant worthwhile?
Well, the dental sealant is something that can be beneficial, and that's one that's a little bit difficult for me to answer without actually seeing your cat's teeth, because we have cats that require full-on dentals once a year in order to clean, polish, and avoid extractions. And there are other cats that are 10 years old before we even have to approach them in that fashion. So the dental sealant is good medicine for sure. And I would purely be speculating to say whether it would be more beneficial to wait to do a full-on dental.
Yeah. There you go, Tony. Thank you for calling. Greg in Mazamani, your turn. Hi, Greg.
Yeah, I've got a Labrador Retriever that just got bred about a week ago, and I'm wondering your thoughts on any folic acid or supplements that would help her pregnancy.
Yeah, well, if you're feeding that dog a good quality, complete, and balanced food and plenty of it, I really feel you're going to be just fine. I feel that those things don't hurt a darn thing, but I really do feel that if you're, as I said, feeding a good, high quality, complete and balanced food, I bet she's going to be just fine.
All right. There you go, Greg. Thank you. Save yourself a couple of bucks there. Perry in Oconto, on to you now. Hi, Perry.
Yes. Thanks, Dr. Stork. Two questions. First one is, can you kind of describe like a home dental care? I have a Springer Spaniel dog that's a year and a half old, loves to chew on Nyla bones and stuff like that. The teeth seem really clean and everything, but is there something else I should be doing? And then my second question is, I'm using Nyla bones right now. I've heard that, you know, those regular femur bones or whatever can cause a cracked tooth. How often does that occur? And how expensive is it if it does?
Okay. Most excellent questions. And I love the fact that your dog's teeth are looking great now, and the Nyla bones could very much be contributing to that. And there are two schools of thought. And here we go back to the old risk versus benefit debate, in the sense that dogs that chew on good old-fashioned femur bones and things like that, quite frankly, their teeth have a tendency to look really, really good. A small percentage of those dogs, if they are really aggressive chewers, will slab fracture a molar or a canine that will eventually require either repair or extraction. And I can't give you an exact percentage of how often that happens because it really depends on how it is that your dog chews. If your dog chews relatively peacefully, then it's not going to happen quite as often. If they really go after it like it's their last meal on earth, then there's a better chance that that dog is going to fracture that tooth. And, you know, lots of dogs playing with other dogs, chewing on things, you know, their mouth gets beat up. There's another tool as far as at-home dental care that has worked better than I would have ever expected it to. I was really skeptical when the commercial dental diets came down the pipe. And I still remember being detailed by a reps that sold us the stuff, and I was really doubtful. I have become a believer, and there are commercial diets that are called things like the dental diet made by Royal Canin. And that stuff is obnoxiously expensive. I tell our clients it's like $2.50 a kibble, which is a gross exaggeration, but it's expensive enough, but it helps. And what most people do with the dental diet is either feed it as treats, because dogs have a tendency to eat it quite well, or they'll mix it in with their normal food. You know, like for my dogs, I'll literally throw four or five of those kibble. They look like frosted mini wheats in there, except they're really dense. And it'll sound like your dog is chewing on the driveway, but it will slow down the formation of tartar and can even help remove tartar that's already there.
Huh. There you go. Perry, thank you very much for calling. Here's a question we haven't had, Dr. Bill. Barbara from Stoughton called, but she couldn't stay with us. She has some of the books you've written, and when they were given to her by her son, and she wonders, can she stop by the clinic to get them autographed?
Oh, for goodness sakes, I'd be happy to do that. That would that would just make my day.
I would think so. That's pretty cool. Barbara, feel free. Oh, man. Jackie emailed us. She has an 8-year-old rescue, looks to be a chow, dislikes water, and will even take a long detour to around to avoid a puddle. Her question is about bathing. Because of his dislike to water, he has only had 2 or 3 baths in his whole life. He's an indoor-outdoor dog. Should she be forcing the issue and bathing him, and is it better to do it in the summer?
I would not, first of all, attempting to match wits and wills with a chow. We feeble people are going to end up on the losing end of that battle each and every time. And it will only serve to make it worse unless you want to go to the trouble of full on classically conditioning him. And I don't know if you've tried things like peanut butter on the wall of the bathtub, licky mats on the wall of the bathtub, different configurations, walk-in showers, and things like that to try and slowly warm him up to the idea. I mean, it would be months before you would ever introduce the element of water. But I mean, if he's a fairly clean living guy and doesn't go out and roll in horse poop and things like that, then it may not be worth the effort.
Okay. Well, you know, when I go on my morning jog around the neighborhood, I like to take notice of the dogs that folks are walking. And in my neighborhood, at least, about 3/4 of the dogs that are out walking, at least 3/4, I think, have another coat to protect them during the winter time. Are there breeds that, I mean, is it a good idea, Bill?
You know, I'm pretty confident that I've been in practice for a minute or two, and I'm pretty confident that 25 years ago, we didn't have all this attire for these dogs. And I'm not sure if my daughter is listening. She's got a 1.5-year old Vizsla that when that dog goes out, anytime it's below 30 degrees, looks, I mean, that dog's got parkas and snowsuits and hats and booties and everything else. The biggest thing, to be honest with you, Larry, that seems to be a challenge with regard to dogs is their paws. And when we have a week like we did last week, when we were double digits below zero, one of my dogs was born on a cattle ranch in Wyoming, and she struggled mightily with her paws on the pavement when it was 12 below zero. So I think that's probably the biggest point of protection. And now, after today's weather, there's going to be all kinds of salt on the pavement, which gets in between the pads and can be really irritating. So dogs don't love to wear things on their paws as a rule, but I think that could be more beneficial than anything.
Yeah. How the heck do you train them to? There are some dogs I would not want to try and train to put booties on them.
Well, the answer is to start early when they're very, very young.
Yeah, yeah, I think you're right about that. But if you've got an older dog, sometimes, you know, they don't want to go to the bathroom because it's so cold outside.
You are absolutely correct. I mean, we've heard stories of card-carrying mastiffs, huge dogs that are tolerant of most conditions that are dividing up their efforts into multiple installations. They run out and pee a little bit and come back in and do it again.
And run back out and do it again. Oh, my gosh. Well, on that happy note, it's always a pleasure to have you with us, Dr. Bill, and I really appreciate the time that you spend with us, and I hope we can do this again.
Well, I hope to be here again and appreciate you, Larry, and all your years of experience.
Well, it's been a lot of fun, and thanks again, Dr. Bill Stork. Dr. Bill Stork owns Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic, and as Barbara from Stoughton in her email says, she wants her books by him autographed. He's written three of them, and I think if you go online to Dr. Bill Stork, you are going to find those copies, and we've talked about them on the show and had a lot of fun. There's some great stories in his books, for sure. Well, just looking ahead, tomorrow on the show, Darren Bush, who's a heck of a paddler, but he also is a snowshoer and he's a cross-country skier, and he's going to be on the show to talk with us about doing any of those things. So I'm looking forward to that. And then we have a check in about an iconic Wisconsin animal, the badger, and find out all about badgers here in Wisconsin. Not the kind that play football, the other kind of badgers or basketball. And that's tomorrow. In the meantime, thank you so much for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.